Welcome to the Pursuing Uncomfortable podcast, where we give you the encouragement you need to lean into the uncomfortable stuff life puts in front of you so you can love your life. If you are ready to overcome all the yuck that keeps you up at night, you're in the right place. I am your host, Melissa Epkin. Let's get going. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the Pursuing Uncomfortable podcast. It's really a gift and a pleasure to have you back and tuning into this episode. Today, I'm introducing you to Terry Tucker. Terry is one of the most influential people that you will meet. He's a motivational speaker. When you speak with Terry or hear him speak, you're just instantly uplifted. You know that your life has a purpose, it can be more, and Terry is the guy that will encourage you and help you to reach those heights in your life. What you don't realize about Terry, when you meet him initially anyway, is the struggle that he has every single day just to be alive. Terry is an example of been there, done that. He's had many different and varied careers, and it's so interesting to hear his background. But he has also had a decade-long battle with cancer that has left him dependent on a drug that makes him very sick and makes every day a challenge and a struggle to be alive. Despite all of that, Terry continues to be an encouraging, uplifting, and motivational person. And he's here today to share with you not just his struggles, but all of the stuff that he has learned in the struggle and his encouragement for you. Terry, welcome to the Pursuing Uncomfortable podcast. I'm so happy you're joining us today. How are you?
I'm great, Melissa. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Me too. And I had a really odd request. I asked my listeners who they would like on the podcast, and they said, well, if you could find someone who has been, you know, someone who's played college basketball, who's run a hospital, negotiated with the SWAT teams, does motivational speaking, someone like that, that's who we would love to have. And I said, perfect. I know the exact right person.
Yeah, one of these days, I got to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up, you know?
Terry, what a pleasure it is and how much fun we're going to have today talking. Let's start out with what you're doing these days.
Yeah, these days I am, kind of in survival mode. I've been battling a rare form of cancer for the last 10 years and have been very fortunate that, you know, sets of circumstances have kind of aligned to the point now where I'm involved in a clinical trial of a drug that probably won't save my life, but at the same time has kept me going, has shrunk the tumors that I have in my lungs. Whereas some of the other people who started on the trial with me are no longer with us because it didn't work for them. So I feel very fortunate. I kind of feel like I'm carrying the torch for the group that started this right now. And it's just, you know, I'm just trying to put as much goodness, positivity, motivation, love back into the world as I can with whatever time I have left. So I'm just enjoying it day by day and seeing where it takes me.
I love it. Now you've put a book out. What's the name of your book?
The book is called Sustainable Excellence, The 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life.
What a captivating title. I love that. Who doesn't want to have an extraordinary life? I do.
Yeah, it's kind of a mouthful, though, you know?
Can you repeat it 5 times and say it once backwards?
No, not even close.
Well, before we get into all that you're doing today, let's back up a little bit and talk about how you got where you are right now. So you can jump back in your story and pick up in whichever career you would like to pick up in and tell us how you got where you are.
Yeah, I guess let me even start further back if you don't mind. I'm the oldest of 3 boys, born and raised on the south side of Chicago. You can't tell this from my voice, but I'm 6'8" tall, and I played college basketball at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. I have a brother who's 6'7", who was a pitcher for the University of Notre Dame baseball team. And I have another brother who's 6'6", who was drafted by the Cleveland Cavaliers in the National Basketball Association. And then my dad was 6'5". So I sort of joke that if you sat behind our family in church growing up, there wasn't a prayer's chance you were going to see anything that was going on in front. But, you know, our 5'8" mother was the boss. You know, it didn't matter how big, tall, strong we were, whatever mom said, that's the way things work. When I graduated from college, I moved home to find a job. I was actually the first person in my family to go to college, to graduate from college. And I was fortunate that I found that first job in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the hamburger chain, in their corporate office in Dublin, Ohio. Unfortunately, I ended up living with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mom care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. As I said, started out in marketing at Wendy's, became a hospital administrator, then made a major pivot in my life and became a police officer, where I was an undercover narcotics investigator. You mentioned a SWAT team hostage negotiator.
Hey, no, wait a minute. An sure. undercover guy.
I knew you were going to say this. This always says
yes, you don't blend.
You're on. At 6'8", you know, how do you do that, John? Yeah. And you know, I never changed my appearance. You know, I never grew a beard. I never grew my hair long. I never did any of that. And the way I describe that is that industry, and certainly illicit drugs as an industry, is motivated by greed. And so if you have money, you're going to find somebody that'll sell you drugs. Now, you have to act a little bit. I remember one time I was working the night shift and had my former partner who was working the day shift call me and said, hey, would you buy tonight? I've got somebody coming down. This was Cincinnati, Ohio. I've got somebody coming down from Dayton that wants to sell mushrooms, psychedelics, psilocybin. And I said, yeah, sure. What's the deal? It's like, I don't know. We got to come up with a cover. So I posed as a professor of metallurgy for the University of Cincinnati. I don't know anything about metal other than you put it out in the rain and it rusts. You know, I mean, that's what Mike's
metallurgy.
Yeah, metallurgy. You know, I mean, but we had to have some kind of a cover. And so we had these five kids that were coming down from Dayton that wanted to sell the mushrooms to get money to party in Cincinnati. And so I met them in the park and, you know, we did the exchange and all of a sudden, five cars swooped in on them. And instead of partying in Cincinnati, they were guests of the Hamilton County Justice Center that night. So it was an interesting time. It was also a very dangerous time. I mean, I was shot at a couple of times. Ooh. You know, people that I worked with had guns pulled on them when they were buying and stuff like that. So it was very dangerous. You know, I mean, we had a lot of fun with it, but it was certainly dangerous.
Now, I do have another question about your time at Wendy's. And if this is classified, I totally get it. But did they share with you, where's the beef? Were you privy to that knowledge?
Well, I was there. So the actress, Clara Peller, who was a former beauty operator from Chicago, was the woman who kept going around saying, where's the beef? And, you know, it got adopted. I think Ronald Reagan, when he was running for president, you know, adopted it and stuff like that. It was a huge success for us. The Academy Awards are what you get in the movies. The Clios are what you get in advertising. And we had Clios all over the place for the Where's the Beef campaign that we had. I never found out where the beef was, but I certainly had a great time being there during that time.
You know, and this is going to age the audience. If you're shaking your head and don't have a clue,
like, well, yeah,
well, that's fine. You're younger than we are.
Right. Much. Yeah, but it was a great time. I loved it, learned a lot. And, you know, it actually helped me when I moved on into hospital administration.
So after you finished helping guests check into their accommodations in Hamilton County, what was next?
So my wife lost her job, and she's always been the primary breadwinner. She lost her job in Cincinnati and was not able to find another one. So I had to leave the police department. We moved to Houston, Texas. She found a job there. And, you know, that was the other interesting part. I worked with enough police officers that their identity was tied to the gun, the badge, and what they did. And while I loved it, and I really felt it was my purpose to do that job, it wasn't who I was. I mean, I was certainly capable of doing other things. And so our daughter was in a private Catholic school. And so I went to them and said, look, I've got certain knowledge and experience from my SWAT days and things like that. How about if I do a school security consulting gig for you? And they were like, yeah, sure. And so I did that and was able to parlay that into now they told other schools. So I started a school security consulting business around the world, or excuse me, not around the world, around the United States. And then I also coached girls' high school basketball. So those were my two diversions, I guess, from after being in law enforcement, because they were definitely different, and they were certainly interesting, because I grew up with brothers. I went to an all-guys Catholic high school. I went to an all-male military college. So coaching girls and having a girl was...
It's a bit different.
It was. I will never forget going to the OBGYN with my wife, and our OBGYN said, do you want to know if it's a boy or a girl? I'm like, yeah, sure. She said, well, you should buy pink. I said, no. You need to keep it in there till it's done. I don't know anything about a girl. So,
You know, and I do have to confess, when you were talking with her school administration, I got this vision in my head. Hi, I have a certain set of skills, even the Liam Neeson reference from Taken.
They're not quite to that level, but, you know.
That's not how you did the call.
No. It was more of a face-to-face kind of thing. I used my height to intimidate them to give me the job. So, yeah.
Excellent. And then what?
Then I got cancer. Mm-hmm. So I was, as I mentioned, I was a girls' high school basketball coach. And one day I had a callus break open on the bottom of my foot, right below my third toe. And initially didn't think much of it, because as a coach, you're on your feet a lot. But after it didn't heal for a couple of weeks, I went to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor friend of mine. And he took an x-ray and he said, Terry, I think you have a cyst in there and I can cut it out. And he did. And he showed it to me. It was just a little gelatin sac with some white fat in it, no dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern. But fortunately or unfortunately, he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. And then 2 weeks later, I received a call from him. And as I said, he was a friend. And the more difficulty he was having explaining what was going on, the more frightened I was becoming, until he finally just laid it out for me and said, you know, Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years. I have never seen this form of cancer. You have a very rare form of melanoma that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands. And because your cancer is so incredibly rare, I recommend that you go to MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston and be treated. And so I did. I had a surgery to remove the tumor on my bottom of my foot. I had all the lymph nodes in my groin removed. And then when I healed, my oncologist put me on a weekly injection of a drug called interferon to help keep the disease from coming back. The side effects of the interferon were that it gave me severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after each injection. I mean, I lost 50 pounds during my therapy. There was one point where I was pretty sure that I was skinny enough that I could go hang gliding on a Dorito. Bad joke.
Well, and when you say flu-like symptoms, I'm guessing you don't mean the respiratory type flu-like symptoms.
No, I mean the shaking, chills, vomiting, throwing up, headache, all that. And that was every week. And I took those weekly injections for almost 5 years. So imagine
literally half of your life.
Yeah.
You're sick.
Yeah. Yeah. I literally, during that period of time, I mean, I was so sick of being sick that I prayed to die. I mean, I was just like, come on, God, this is ridiculous. I remember when my oncologist suggested it, and I had a grandmother of a player on my team who was on interferon for a liver issue that she had. And I was talking to her about it. She said, oh yeah, I was on it for 6 months. Yeah, it's not real good, but you can handle it. And so I said to my oncologist, like, yeah, I can do this for 6 months. And she said, how about 5 years? And I looked at her like, you're nuts. Mm-hmm. That's not something that you should put anybody through. I don't care. It was nasty. And then the funny thing is, it's not a cure. It's just, we're trying to kick the can down the road and buy you more time for more therapies to happen. 2017, I end up in the intensive care unit with a fever of 108 degrees, which usually is not compatible with being alive due to the toxicity of the interferon. So I have to stop it. And almost immediately, the cancer comes back in the exact same spot on my foot. where it had presented 5 years earlier. And then 2018, my left foot was amputated, two more surgeries in 2019, and then 2020, and an undiagnosed tumor in my, I guess, ankle area that grew large enough that it fractured my tibia, my shin bone. And my only recourse right in the middle of the pandemic was to have my left leg amputated above the knee, and found out I had tumors in my lungs, which I'm being treated for now. Wow. And on that uplifting story.
Yeah, that's just a gift that keeps on giving.
Absolutely. Let's get some popcorn. And
my goodness. Well, I'm glad you're here to tell the story.
Me too.
And I'm guessing that through your experience, you've learned some things along the way.
I've learned a lot of things. I've learned certainly that, you know, you really don't know yourself until you've been tested by adversity, you know, until something really major in your life's happened. I'll be honest with you, cancer has made me a better person. It's made me a better individual. But the thing that I talk a lot about are what I call my four truths that I've learned. And they're not mine. I don't think you can own a truth, but they're four things that I've kind of come to understand and apply in my life. I call them the bedrock of my soul. They're just a good place to build a life off of. And I'll give them to you. I have on a post note here on my desk. I see them multiple times during the day. They constantly get reinforced. So the first one is, you need to control your mind, or your mind is going to control you. The second one is, embrace the pain and the difficulty that we all experience in life, and use that pain and difficulty to make you a stronger and more resilient individual. The third one is more of a, I guess, a legacy truth, for lack of a better word. And it's this: what you leave behind is what you weave in the hearts of other people. And then the fourth one, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. As long as you don't quit, you can never be defeated. So I use those truths in making decisions in my life. Do I want to do this? Do I want to get involved, you know, in this project? Do I want to, you know, do this therapy for my cancer and things like that? And they certainly have helped me. And then the other three things that I call my three truths, which are my faith, my family, and my friends, have certainly gotten me through this as well.
For sure. Yeah, those four truths, there's a lot of wisdom in those. Mindset. You know, that first one, control your mind or your mind will control you. I remember as a kid, that first time that my mom and dad let me stay by myself at the house. When they were getting ready to leave, you know, I was all grown up, tough kid. I'm like, I was fine. Why are you still here? Go ahead and go. And they hadn't backed out of the driveway. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm alone. Oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And I'm watching out the window. Are they back yet? It's like they haven't even gotten to the stop sign yet. And I realized, okay, maybe if I change the way I'm thinking about this, it might go a little better. But that was the first time I remember having a significant moment where my mindset, when I changed my mindset intentionally and experienced a better outcome because of it.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, when I was growing up, again, I'm going to date myself a little bit here, but when I was growing up, Bobby Knight was the basketball coach at Indiana University. And yeah, I mean, Illinois, you're close. I mean, you know Bobby.
Lou Hansen.
And I had a guy I played against in Chicago, a guy by the name of Isaiah Thomas, who went to play for Bobby Knight in Indiana, won a national championship, and then went on to the NBA and won a couple NBA championships. And I used to see him. Pardon?
I've heard of him.
You've heard of Isaiah? Yeah. So I was lucky to play against him. So I'd see Isaiah in the summer when he would come home. And, you know, we would come home and, you know, I was asking him about Knight, because Knight kind of had a reputation of being a little bit of a hothead, for lack of a word. And I said, what's it like for playing with Knight? He's like, no, the guy's great. I mean, he tries to get the most out of you. But he told me a saying that Knight had, which I thought was interesting. And it was pretty simple. He said, and this is what it was. He said, Knight used to always tell us, mental is to physical as 4 is to 1. So here's this great coach, you know, teaching premier athletes how to use their bodies to be great basketball players. But what he's really saying with that quote is that your mind is 4 times more important than your physical body is.
Absolutely. And there was no more frustrating coach to be on the opposite side of I remember watching countless Illinois games when they were ahead by 10 points. And you get down, you know, the game starts for Bobby Knight when there are about, what, 30 seconds left on the clock or so? 10-point lead with 12 seconds left on the clock? Not safe. Not safe at all.
Nope.
He might be onto something with that mindset.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting. And that's, you know, certainly as an athlete, you learn that you need to control your mind. And again, here we go, dating myself again. 1976, there was a U.S. gold medal winning Olympic swimmer by the name of Shirley Babashaw, who had one of the greatest quotes, very simple quote, but a great quote that she said. And this is all it was. She said, winners think about what they want to happen. Losers think about what they don't want to happen. So winners can override their negative brain, their negative thought, and, you know, focus on what they want to happen. Whereas losers only concentrate on the negative aspects and can't see the value of pursuing a goal or a dream.
Yeah, their fear.
Yeah.
You know, and it came to a real fruition to me during the Winter Olympics this February with that ice skater, that guy, that these Olympic events can, in many cases, they're a test of the mind. Everyone in the world knew who the best was in more than one of the sports.
Yeah.
There was one person who physically dominated in that sport. Olympics test who has done the mental practice and the mental work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to put in, you know, the reps, whatever that is, you know, whatever sport we're talking about. But it's another thing. And my brother who played in the national, but he didn't play. He was drafted by the Cleveland Cavaliers. Actually was the last person.
This is the short the one, right?
The 6'6" one. Yeah, exactly. You know, he and I have many times talked about if we, you know, had the knowledge that we have today in terms of training, not just training our bodies, but training our minds, you know, 30, 40 years ago when we were, you know, playing, we would have been so much better athletes. than we were, because we just didn't know all the physical side, but more importantly, the mental side and how important that is.
Absolutely. And you don't have to be a professional athlete at the top of your field for that to be the case.
Right.
Day-to-day life, all the ordinary stuff, mindset matters so much.
It does. Absolutely.
And then your second one, the embrace the pain and difficulty we experience in life and use that to make you stronger and a more resolute individual. Well, that's the whole basis of this podcast. In 20 plus years of ministry, watching people who lean into those difficult experiences and situations in life, they overcome them and they become stronger because of it. And conversely, watching others who shy away from it or who deny it or try to hide from it, they continue to struggle. And there's power in leaning into it. There's power in overcoming it. And, you know, if you lean into the difficult stuff and you do the things that you're frightened of, eventually you're going to run out of things that you're frightened of.
Yeah, I mean, we're all going to experience pain in our lives. You know, and it doesn't have to be cancer pain or even any kind of an illness. You could, you know, break up with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, or, you know, not get the promotion at work that you think you deserve, or have a fender bender on the way to work. Whatever. We're all going to experience pain in our lives. Pain is inevitable. Suffering, on the other hand, suffering's optional. Suffering's what you do with that pain. Do you take it and use it to make you a stronger and more determined person? Or do you wallow in it and want people to feel sorry for you and feel sorry for yourself? You know, I try to do this every day of my life, to do one thing that makes me nervous, that makes me uncomfortable, that scares me, that's potentially embarrassing. You know, it doesn't have to be a big thing, but if you do those small things every day, when the big things in life hit, you know, we lose somebody close to us, we lose our job, we're living out of our car. We've all heard the stories. If you do those small things every day, you'll be so much more resilient to handle the big things when they hit you in life.
Absolutely. I can't emphasize that one enough. I love it. And then your third truth, that what you leave behind is what you weave into the hearts of others. That is beautiful.
Yeah, I think, you know, people get so hung up with death, you know, and I like to ask people, you know, what are people going to say about you at your funeral? And maybe more importantly, what do you want people, you know, to say about you at your funeral? And I remember when I had my leg amputated and I found out I had these tumors in my lungs, I went with my wife to the mortuary, to the cemetery, and to our church, and I planned my funeral. And because I go on podcasts and give talks about motivation and need to keep moving forward, I actually had some people kind of reach out and were like, well, don't you think that's kind of defeatist that you're planning your own funeral? And, you know, I kind of looked at them like, well, the last time I checked, we're all going to die. Don't think anybody's working on a cure for life right now. But, yeah, you know,
mortality rate still 100%.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. I mean, everybody dies, but not everybody really lives. And I heard a Native American Blackfoot proverb years ago that went like this. When you were born, you cried and the world rejoiced. Mm-hmm. Live your life in such a way so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. That's what I want. That's what I'm looking for.
Oh, that's beautiful.
You can use it.
Love that.
Take it. Steal it. Use it.
And credit it appropriately.
Oh, I don't care. Hey, you know.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for sharing that one.
Yeah.
And of course, as long as you don't quit, you will never be defeated. Failure's only failure when you stop.
It is. And the way I look at that, you know, I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but the way it resonates with me is that someday my pain is going to end. You know, may end through surgery, may end through some kind of a new medication that gets developed. Quite frankly, it may end when I die. But if I quit, if I give up, if I give in to pain, then pain will always be a part of my life.
Very true. Are you still taking interferon?
No. I'm not taking interferon. I'm on a sort of a sister drug to it called interleukin 2. It's not interleukin 2. It's a clinical trial of a drug. Interleukin 2 is just a really nasty drug that usually you have to get in the hospital because it does all kinds of things to you, and they need to be able to take care of those things when they happen. But what this drug is designed to do is accentuate the good things about interleukin 2. And sort of take away some of the bad things of interleukin 2. That's why it's kind of a new drug, and hopefully it's probably not going to save my life, but it may save the life of somebody down the road, you know, somebody that I don't even know. And that's kind of when I go for treatment, and I go for a week, I have 2 weeks off, then I go for a week and I have 2 weeks off, and I'm on, I don't know, cycle 24, 25 or whatever it is. And the way I look at it is, and I think this is important regardless, you know, you get up in the morning, you go to work. Which way do you look at that? I have to go to work or I get to go to work? You know, I mean, which handle do you want to grab today? And we all get to the point where some days it's like, I have to go to work. I really don't want to do it, you know, but I get that, you know, but for me, it's, I get to go. Yeah, I get to go and throw up and shake and have a headache and all that kind of stuff. But that's one thing I learned from team sports, the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. You know, and you realize on a team that if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, you let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life. So like I said, this drug may not save my life, but it may save the life of somebody 5 years from now or 10 years from now, based on the data that the doctors are gleaning from all my tests and blood work and things like that. And for me, that's being part of something that's bigger than me.
So Terry, how has all of this changed? And maybe changed isn't the correct verb here, but how does all of this come together when you go to a doctor for something else? And maybe you haven't had something else yet, but to the person listening to this, who goes to the doctor and is choosing among different treatment options, how can your experience help others to be discerning in their own medical care and choices?
I think it's, you know, and I am not one of these people, but I've seen people that, you know, they get whatever it is, you know, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, whatever it is. And then they just sort of sit back and turn their entire life over to somebody with a white coat and a bunch of initials after their name. And I am not like that. I want to be involved in my healthcare. I want my life to be shaped by the decisions that I made, not by the ones I didn't or the ones that somebody else made for me. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say I have any medical background. I don't. I mean, I worked in a hospital, but, you know, I certainly wasn't in any way involved with patient care, and the patients were very happy about that. So, you know, I guess I would suggest people understand that you can do that. You can turn your life over to a physician if that's what you want to do, or you can be actively involved in it. But also understand, because I did this, when I found out I had, you know, cancer, I went through all the emotions of grief that we would associate with grief, you know, with the denial. No, it can't possibly be. I've done everything right in my life. And, you know, then I got mad and then I would bargain. And eventually I got to a point where, okay, these are the cards that I've been dealt and I'm going to have to play them. So if you get into that situation where you're feeling down and you're feeling gloomy and, you know, it's all woe is me and stuff like that. And I get there and, you know, there's no S on my chest. I do not wear a cape. And I'm going to tell you a story and it's going to sound really weird when I start, but hang with me on this one.
Okay.
So I read a story about a research project that was conducted at Johns Hopkins University back in the 1950s. And it was a very simple experiment that this professor did. He took rats, this is where it gets kind of weird. He took rats and he put them in a tank of water that were over their head. And he wanted to see how long the rat would tread water. And the average rat treaded water for about 15 minutes. And just as the rat was getting ready to sink and drown, he reached in, grabbed the rat, dried it off, let it rest for a while, and then put that rat, same rat, back in that exact same tank of water. And the second time around, on average, those rats treaded water for 60 hours. So think about that. First time, 15 minutes, that's all I can do. I'm at the end of my rope, can't go on any further. Second time, 60 hours. Which said to me two things. One, the importance of hope in our life. Never lose hope. Never think that, you know, I'm doomed. A doctor may tell you, you know, you got 6 months to live. The doctor doesn't know you. They don't know your resolve. They don't know your courage. They don't know what's in your head. They don't know your mindset. So don't take that and take it as gospel and like, well, I'm going to die in 6 months. I'm not going to tell you not to plan, you know, get your final affairs in order. But at the same time, the doctor doesn't know you. So the first thing was hope. Never lose hope. And the second thing is just how much more our physical bodies can handle than we ever thought they could. My wife works with a young man who's a former Navy SEAL, some of the toughest men in the world. And the SEALs have what they call their 40% rule, which basically says if you're at the end of your rope, you're done. You can't go on. You're only at 40% of your maximum, and you still have another 60% left to give to yourself. So I've just come to understand that our bodies can handle a whole lot more than we ever give them credit for. So I guess that was kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but hopefully there's something in there that people can use.
Love it. And I really want to thank you for acknowledging for all of us that you do have those dark days that, you know, because it's easy to imagine you as this conquering hero, the star athlete, the policeman, the hostage negotiator, the school defender, security person, all of these things. And to share with us that even in the midst of all of this stuff, that even you have the really dark days and all the doubts and all of that, that's really important for all of us to hear. Those come with the territory.
They do. We're human. I'm a human being. As much as I talk about motivation and the need to keep moving forward, there are those days when I'm in treatment and I'm crying. You know, there are those days when, you know, my head is down and I feel defeated. But one of the things that helps me, in addition to the stories that I told you, was that when we're in that situation, we're looking inward. We're turning inward. You know, woe is me. It's all about me. And I found a way to kind of get out of that, at least for me, is to find somebody else to help. You know, to find somebody else that, hey, you know, how's it going? And stop thinking about me. And project what's going on with you, not project, but use what's going on with you to help somebody else, you know, to say, hey, how's it going? Hey, let's talk. You feeling bad? How things, you know, and all of a sudden now you're not focused on you anymore. You're focused on somebody else. And I don't care how bad and dark you're feeling, focusing on somebody else is going to brighten you and move your attitude into a better space than it was when you're just thinking about how bad it is for you.
Oh, that'll preach.
Amen, sister.
That is so true. So true. Go and serve.
Yeah.
In whatever way you can. If you can't get out of bed, you can make a phone call and encourage someone. And if you can't use your voice and you can't make a phone call and you can't encourage someone, you can pray for someone. You can picture them being lifted up and experiencing something good. As long as we are alive, we are able to serve someone else in some capacity. And like you said, that has such a powerful way of refocusing our thoughts, which changes our mindset. It refocuses what we are capable of. It helps us to lean into the difficult things. It has so much power to help ourselves and others. I think it's fantastic that there is a reward, an intrinsic personal reward for helping other people. It's kind of a win-win. That's a good system.
It is. I like it.
Yeah. Big fan.
Absolutely.
Terry, as we close today, are there any parting thoughts or any parting words that you would like to share with these listeners?
If I could, I'll end with a story, if you don't mind.
Love it.
Always been a big fan of Westerns growing up. You know, my mom and dad used to let me stay up late and watch, you know, Gunsmoke and Bonanza. Again, your audience is like, what's this guy talking about? You know, Gunsmoke, Bonanza, my favorite.
Well, yeah, there are some that are hanging with us here.
That's good. All right. I like it. You know, Wild Wild West. 1993, the movie Tombstone came out. You may have seen it. Huge blockbuster. Starred Val Kilmer as a man by the name of John Doc Holliday and Kurt Russell as a man by the name of Wyatt Earp. Now, Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp were two living, breathing human beings who walked on the face of the earth. They're not made-up characters just from the movie. Now, Doc was called Doc because he was a dentist by trade, but pretty much Doc Holliday was a gunslinger and a card shark. And Wyatt Earp, his entire life, had been a lawman. And somehow these two men from entirely divergent backgrounds come together and form this very close friendship. And at the end of the movie, Doc is dying at a sanitarium of tuberculosis in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is about 3 hours from where I live. The real Doc Holliday died in that sanitarium, and he's buried in the Glenwood Springs Cemetery. And Wyatt at this point in his life is destitute. He has no money, has no job, has no prospects for a job. So every day he comes to play cards with Doc, and the two men pass the time that way. And in this almost last scene of the movie, the two men are talking about what they want out of life. And Doc says, you know, I was in love with my cousin when I was younger, but she joined a convent over the affair. But she's all that I ever wanted. And then he looks at Wyatt and he says, what about you, Wyatt? What do you want? And Wyatt kind of nonchalantly says, I just want to lead a normal life. And Doc looks at him and says, there's no normal. There's just life. And get on with living yours. You know, Melissa, you and I probably know people are sitting out there listening to us that are like, well, when this happens, I'll have a normal life. Or when this occurs, I'll have a successful life. Or when this arises, I'll have a significant life. What I'd like to leave your audience with is this. Don't wait. Don't wait for life to come to you. Get out there. Find the reason you were put on the face of this earth. Use your unique gifts and talents and live that reason. Because if you do, at the end of your life, I'm going to promise you two things. Number one, you're going to be a whole lot happier. And number two, you're going to have a whole lot more peace in your heart.
And the world is going to cry as you rejoice.
Yeah.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. If this encouraged you, please consider subscribing to our show and leaving a rating and review so we can encourage even more people just like yourself. We drop a new episode every Wednesday, so I hope you continue to drop in and to be encouraged to lean into and overcome all the uncomfortable stuff life brings your way.